WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. A couple of weeks ago, we woke up to reports that President Bush had passed out at a state dinner in Japan. It was just the flu, but it reminded us all that the vice president truly is just a heartbeat away from the presidency. Perhaps no vice president in recent memory has been held in such low regard as Dan Quayle. The cavalier manner in which he was selected by Bush is one reason why Jules Whitcover wrote the new book, Crapshoot, about how vice presidents are chosen. Whitcover is a veteran political reporter and syndicated columnist. Another reason he wrote the book is that he has personally witnessed the assassination of one presidential candidate, Robert Kennedy, the attempted assassination of one president, Gerald Ford, and an assassination hoax against another presidential candidate, Ronald Reagan. As far as Whitcover is concerned, choosing a vice president who can learn on the job isn't good enough.
The fact is that in 1988, when George Bush ran for president, his slogan was ready from day one. He was referring, of course, to his great number of high jobs that he's held in the past to indicate that he was ready to take over at a moment's notice. The vice president, however, also should have as a slogan ready from day one, because the possibility of him having to take over on short notice, perhaps even in the first day of his vice presidency, is present. You'll recall in 1981 that George Bush was vice president only a few weeks when the assassination attempt was made on Ronald Reagan, and we learned later that it was almost succeeded. So my argument in this book is not against Dan Quayle, but really against George Bush and against other presidents who don't make a responsible choice. I think that the idea that the vice presidency is a training ground is fine. As long as the vice president has the time and the country has the luxury of him being in that office for some time. But I believe the majority of the vice presidents who have succeeded to the presidency succeeded in the first year of their vice presidency. So therefore, the vice president should be ready to take over, not the vice presidency, which is a job that doesn't require much heavy lifting, but be ready to take over the presidency from the moment he goes into office.
But instead, you think vice presidential running mates are chosen for what reasons? To round out the ticket?
Often to round out the ticket geographically or ethnically, perhaps. But I think that we've had a mixed record on vice presidents. That's why the book is called Crapshoot. It's not that every vice president has been a bad one. More often than not, they've been non-entities who have disappeared from the scene. But at least since World War II, vice presidents have not disappeared from the scene. And the office has now become a stepping stone, and probably the most important stepping stone to the presidency, quite aside from the matter of accidental succession. In six of the last seven presidential campaigns, for example, either one or both of the presidential nominees had been vice president. So although the vice presidency used to be a job avoided by ambitious politicians and a really a dead end, because for most of the Republic, the history of the Republic, a vice president served for only one term and were out. So therefore, it was not a job that people welcomed. But in recent years, it has been a job that people have welcomed because of the recent record that it is indeed the prime stepping stone to the presidency.
Did you, during the course of the research for your book, get some new insights into how George Bush made the decision to get Quayle to be his running mate?
Well, I got some ideas, but I wouldn't say they were insights, or would I be able to say that this is really the reason? When George Bush did select Dan Quayle originally, he merely stated that he thought Dan Quayle represented the next generation, and he mentioned a couple of fairly minor legislative acts in support of his choice. And he has never to this day really given a detailed explanation of why he picked Dan Quayle. My own guess is that George Bush served for 8 years as vice president in a manner in which he was widely criticized as being overly subservient and super loyal. But my own theory is that George Bush convinced himself that that is the way, indeed, that a vice president should behave. And therefore, when the time came for him to make a choice, he wanted somebody who, in a general way, served the vice in the vice presidency as he did. Also, when he took over the party at the convention in New Orleans in 1988, his advisors, some of his advisors, told him it was important for him to do something dramatic, to show that he was indeed in charge and coming out of the shadow of Ronald Reagan. And he did something dramatic, certainly in naming Dan Quayle, who was who sent the convention into shock.
What about the theory that Quayle was chosen because he was young enough to perhaps have appeal to the baby boom generation, and he was considered very attractive?
Oh, sure. I think that was that obviously was a factor, but it proved not to really work out that way in the election.
What's your assessment of Quayle's performance so far as vice president? He's no longer like the shocking choice to be the running mate. He's been, you know, performing in that position for several years.
I think he's been adequate as vice president. I think he's worked quite hard to get on top of the relatively routine tasks given to him. I went on a trip to Eastern Europe with him last spring. He handled most of the ceremonial assignments adequately. He was well briefed and seemed to absorb the briefings. But I came away nevertheless feeling that there was not much innovative thought there. There was not much sense of real leadership. And I think I get back to my other point that being vice president is not a job requiring heavy lifting, and that is not what you need to gauge somebody on how they perform those ceremonial duties, but whether they are perceived as being capable of taking over the presidency. Which brings me to a point that I'd like to elaborate on, if I may. There's been so much talk about Quayle, whether or not he is qualified, and you know, who's really to say whether any person is qualified to become president in advance? We've had vice presidents who were good and didn't seem in advance that they would be. But I think there's this point: when a vice president takes over, either through the death of a president or his resignation, the country goes into a period of trauma. We saw it, I think, indisputably, with the assassination of John Kennedy in 1963, and we saw it again to a degree in 1974 with the resignation of Richard Nixon. In both those cases, the vice president who assumed the office was a man who was perceived by the people as being competent to get the country through this very traumatic period. Lyndon Johnson in the first instance, Gerald Ford perhaps lesser, but still seen as a competent person in the second instance. I think that's what we have to think about, that the country does go into a trauma when we have that kind of a shock. And it's important that the person who is going to move up into the presidency be perceived as able to get the country through this crisis. I would just suggest that if something happened to George Bush tonight, Dan Quayle would not be perceived as a person who would be able to get the country through that traumatic experience as Lyndon Johnson did in 1963 or as Gerald Ford did in 1974.
Do you think that George Bush should have basically dumped Quayle and chosen a different vice presidential running mate this time around?
Well, my own judgment is, as I indicated, that there are probably people who would instill more confidence. I'm sure there were people who would instill more confidence than Dan Quayle does. But I don't think it's likely that we're going to see that happen. George Bush, after all, contended that Dan Quayle was ready to be president, or at least that was the implication in his selection in 1988 of Dan Quayle. So the idea that he would, 4 years later, in effect, say he was not qualified is not likely to happen. I mean, if they did replace him, I think what would have to happen would be that people around the president would have to go to Quayle and say, look, you're hurting the president's chances of re-election, and the decent thing to do is to step aside. I'm not altogether sure that would work. Interestingly, in 1956, Harold Stassen urged President Eisenhower to drop Richard Nixon. And in fact, Eisenhower did call Nixon in and suggest that he might like to be Secretary of Defense. Nixon refused to buckle to that and stayed on the ticket.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jules Whitcover, and his new book is called Crapshoot, Rolling the Dice on the Vice Presidency, and it's a historical overview of the vice presidency and a look at the vice president today. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is syndicated columnist Jules Whitcover, whose new book is on the vice presidency. Do you think that whoever wins the Democratic nomination will choose their vice presidential running mate differently than Bush, having learned some kind of lesson by the way Quayle was received?
Well, the fact is that over the last several years, the Democrats have gone out about picking a vice president in a different way. You'll recall that Jimmy Carter in 1976 had a number of prominent Democrats troop down to Plains, and he interviewed them personally and spent a great deal of time examining the possibilities. Michael Dukakis did the same thing. It's interesting to me that the Republicans have viewed that process as demeaning, and they've criticized it, and they have said, most of them, that they are not going to put the prospective vice presidential nominees through this demeaning process. I think that's very short-sighted, and I think maybe one of the reasons they got into trouble with the Dan Quayle selection. Not so much that George Bush would have made a different choice, but the visible examination of Quayle might have created the same sort of stir in the Republican Party before the convention that did in fact occur at the convention when the news came that it was going to be Quayle.
Would you like to see the process reformed by which the president chooses his vice presidential running mate?
Well, if voters did their job, that is, that if they saw a choice made by the presidential nominee that they felt was reckless or irresponsible or cavalier and punished the presidential nominee for making that choice, then I would say the system is fine. But the fact is that voters don't do that. They don't vote for the second man on the ticket, and they don't hold the first man on the ticket responsible for the person who he selects as his running mate. So I would like to see some kind of backstop for the public, some protection against an irresponsible or reckless choice. One of the ideas that's been around for some time and I would like to see resurrected is the idea that there would not be a running mate on the ticket, that the convention would only nominate a presidential nominee. Then after the election, the president-elect would then nominate a vice president subject to the confirmation of Congress, basically the same procedure that's followed now in the 25th Amendment. I think there are some advantages to that approach. One is that the president-elect obviously would not have to consider geography, ethnicity, religion, or any other factor in selecting his vice president other than the one that they all say they use, but they seldom do, that is to pick the person best qualified. Also, there are a number of very qualified people who don't want to go through the rigors of a campaign, and they might be more willing to serve if that was a procedure. They would, of course, have to go before Congress and face interrogation, but also so would the president-elect. Now, when it would be harder to require a president, a sitting president, to come in and defend his choice. Because the president could say, well, you know, because of conflict, because of a separation of powers, a president should not be required to appear before Congress. But a president-elect would not be in office, so Congress could require him to come in and say why in great detail, in considerable detail, why he made the choice. And I would just suggest that if that kind of procedure had been in place in 1988, George Bush may have thought twice about picking Dan Quayle if he knew he had to come in and defend him in depth, something that, as I said before, George Bush has not done to this day.
What gives you confidence that this process would work better? A lot of people have been confirmed by congressional committees who a lot of other people think are highly unqualified to serve, so I'm not sure that you'd be any more satisfied with the choice.
There's no assurance that it would be a better choice, but at least it would not be one person's choice solely and without any challenge.
There'd be some check on it.
It would be some check, and that's the thing that I think is necessary. That if the presidential nominee makes a good choice, fine. If he doesn't, we're stuck with it, and we might be stuck with it in this process too. But at least there would be a review by the elected representatives of the people.
How many times have you covered the New Hampshire primaries?
Since the 60s.
What do you like about it and what do you really dread about this time of year?
Well, I like about New Hampshire is that it's a small state. You can stay in one place, get your laundry done. You can travel all over the state and come back and sleep in the same hotel room every night. Get to know a lot of the people who have been there for years. And because it is retail campaigning, the candidates, although they do use a great deal of television now, which whereas a few years ago they didn't because it came out of Boston and it was too costly, they use a lot now. They still do retail campaigning, and it's a leveling process. You don't have to have a huge amount of money to get your case across, and I think that's good.
What do you mean by retail campaigning?
I mean going door to door, going to town halls, going to churches, and meeting people one on one.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
When are you going back to New Hampshire?
Tonight.
Have a good trip.
Thank you.
Jules Woodcover's new book is Crapshoot, Rolling the Dice on the Vice Presidency.